Hello and welcome to Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer broadcaster, Ben, bringing you this week's Sports Illustrated magazine. In this program, we'll be continuing the December issue of Sports Illustrated, covering a variety of articles, including football, hockey, running, and more. We'll also be covering some articles from Athlon Sports and ESPN. Thanks again for listening. Let's get started. The first article I'll be covering today is Bang Up Job. He's a rough and tumble Scot who was raised on rugby. But don't be fooled. Richie Gray, aka the Collision King, is using a cerebral approach to change the way NFL teams think about the way their players hit each other and make the game safer. By Greg Bishop. A disillusioned rugby lifer walks into a local pub in his small Scottish Borders hometown in 2006, but the only walks in a bar joke that day is on him. For the previous 12 years, Richie Gray had worked for the Scottish Rugby Union as its development czar. Note the past tense. Earlier that month, the organization laid him off. "I was disillusioned," he says now. 19 years later, a real kick in the teeth. That night, Gray gathers with his mates from childhood, rugby gladiators. All these scarred, squatty men grew up here in Galatials, a town of 12,600, where textile mills churned out cashmere, and Gray's father coached the province's team. There's a family-run cinema, an architectural trail, and manicured gardens. The town is a living postcard. Its quaintness in contrast with the worn faces of the tough bastards raised on rugby. Gray orders a malt whiskey. Same as always. He's more than distinguished. He's newly married, with a child on the way. A mortgage he just closed and no job. He doesn't doubt he could find another gig in rugby. But that's no longer what he wants. He's thinking bigger, broader. After a whiskey, or three, Gray drops his cautious stance on his own future and says the quiet part, what he really wants, out loud. "I'm going to be different. I'm going to concentrate on contact and collision only. And I'm going to become the best in the world at it." When these mates reaffix their respective jaws to their faces, they start laughing. Big belly guffaws, doubling over, wondering if he's delusional or joking, or both. "You'll never work again," one tells Gray. Gray, in contrast, sees the future. Contact sports, he argues, are played by ever bigger, ever faster, ever stronger people, each trained, conditioned, and fortified with modern performance and recovery methods, meaning more collisions, more forceful collisions, and, in all likelihood, more injuries from the physics involved alone. On this night, Gray makes his argument. But stop there. Oh no. He vows to become the world's foremost contact collision coach. To do that, he tells the men who laugh at him he must stay in rugby. But he must also do something no one like him had ever before considered. "I'm going to have to be involved in the NFL, Gray says. Everyone at the table erupts once more into a round of laughter. At the end of a Zoom call over the summer, Gray mentioned his branding. He has t-shirts. He rises from his office chair in Scotland and grabs one, proudly displaying it on the laptop screen. The Collision King. This is him. But Richie Gray is not some barbarian who laughs at science. He reads dense research papers for fun. He wants collision sports to be as safe as possible, and he has ideas. So many ideas for how to do this, along with methodology, equipment, contacts, and experience. This might sound audacious, delusional, an oxymoron. Safer collision sports. His quest winds across an ocean, over two decades, to a sport that devotes little time or resources towards the craft of tackling, despite, you know, a tackle ending the majority of plays. Gray has already done this in rugby, his approach grounded on development of skill and technique. As humans collide with other humans. From consulting for NFL teams for almost a decade to being brotherly shoved into prominence after helping hone the Eagles' tush-push, He has always seen football as two simple endeavors, blocking and tackling. Schematics, Gray believes, long ago overtook technical accuracy in relative importance to NFL teams. I saw an area of the game that was being ignored, he says, although it was the biggest single challenge in player health and safety. As a kid in Scotland, Gray still stumbled into America's favorite collision sport. By age 12, he knew that every Sunday on Channel 4, the network played a tape-delayed broadcast of a featured NFL game. He'd settle into the living room near the massive window overlooking Galatials. He loved football collisions and fell for the sport's best players and teams: Dan Marino, Joe Theismann, Marcus Allen, Eric Dickerson, Walter Payton, and the 1985 Bears. One Christmas, he received a bona fide NFL jersey, Marino's Aqua number 13. Valerie Gray gave birth to Richie in April 1970. He was the oldest of three tough brothers. Quaint backdrops aside, the south of Scotland was known as the Lawless Lands. It's where William Wallace planned his raids on England. The Romans, known for their gladiator toughness, gave up fighting the Lawless South. They built Hardian's Wall 25 miles from Galatials for their own protection. Reavers, similar to modern-day gangsters, rode horses from town to town. Each was then constructed and fortified on principles of defense and attacking. I'm fascinated in why we do what we do, Gray says. Does your history and your culture define who you are and why? I think it does. His father, Johnny, now 84, introduced Richie to rugby when the boy turned 5. Johnny coached many of the country's seminal rugby figures, and Richie became a ball boy for his father's squads. I was, he says, brought up in collision and contact. Richie recalls the rugby field in front of his primary school. The sport was part of his curriculum. If he or friends had a rugby ball and 5 minutes, they played. Wherever, whenever. Full contact, no warm-up. They didn't need a pitch. They used hillsides, grass patches, and flat stretches of nearby woods, even if that meant occasionally running into trees, which sparked his ingenuity. They all played Border League rugby, the oldest and perhaps most brutal league in the world. Rugby, like professional football, presented almost no safety regulations in those days. Players could jump on top of competitors, leading with their cleats, as well as punch and elbow. Richie's scars are part of his expertise. The first, age 12, top of right ear sliced open, part of said ear ripped off, dangling. Richie was proud. Same as the times, plural. He broke his nose, same as the time another collision collapsed that nose into his face. Same as when he broke bones, tore ligaments, dislocations, whatever. At 18, he earned a spot on the Galatials team. In 1999, he captained that squad to its first Scottish Cup triumph. He represented his country at high school and college levels and flirted with the national team, but wasn't quick or athletic enough. Especially not after one opponent knee-dropped him and tore his ACL in a college-age World Cup appearance. To understand the Collision King, one of one career, start with collision sports caveman era. For all his brawn, Gray also approached rugby from an intellectual bent. He completed his degree in physical education, with honors, in 1995. That same year, rugby in Scotland went professional. The Scottish Rugby Union offered a meager salary, £25,000, to make him a rugby development officer slash coach. Gray didn't have the faintest clue what that even meant. Still, no one had been paid to participate in rugby before. He spent the next 5 years creating a development model from scratch. This wasn't his father's rugby any longer. Johnny took his first coaching gig, Greatest, in 1969. His approach wasn't exactly scientific. He brought oranges for his players to consume at halftime. His pregame notes from his greatest triumph, a victory over the Australian national team, consisted of a mere 4 lines. Richie had access to information his father could never have envisioned, allowing the younger Gray to study the world's best teams. He ordered books on strategy and performance training from all over the world. He collected VHS tapes, piling them near his television until the stacks stood higher than the TV. He devoured documentaries, also on performance, even one featuring Olympic rowing coaches. His family refers to Gray's endless pursuit of knowledge as his zombie mode. He'd often just disappear into the garage to begin another round of tinkering. When Gray made his first contact/collision sled in 2010, he named it the Collision King. It took so long to construct just one that after he finished, his wife said, "Yeah, you'll not be doing that again." Gray recently finished his 52nd contact collision device and completed the final adjustments to another enhanced sled, Collision King 2. As the rule of contact sports changed, so did the equipment Gray assembled in that garage. He now develops and sells those products internationally, tackle dummies, handheld sleds, etc., under his GSI Performance umbrella, which Gray created in 2010. His approach is based on three critical factors: equipment, methodology, and analysis. Each relates to high performance, where gains occur at slim margins. To that end, Gray applied for dozens of patents, design rights, and trademarks over the past 15 years. Rugby development took Gray to South Africa to the coaching staff of its national team, the mighty Springboks. While there in 2015, he received an unexpected phone call from the head of performance for the Dolphins. Wayne Diesel told Gray that his staff had scrutinized statistics from Rugby World Cups and had come across Gray's influence. In May 2016, the Dolphins flew him to Florida for a week to assess their defenders' tackling techniques and meld minds with the Miami's coaches. Gray didn't attempt to fool the locker room. He delivered brutal honesty, centering his opening salvo on his passion for collisions. He wanted accurate, aggressive, dominant, physical players, not merely the most physical in the league, the most physical on the planet. Gray spoke, as he likes to say, from the cage. He understood athletes, injuries, how it felt to deliver collisions and endure them. The first Dolphins visit went so well, Miami brought him back several times that season. Individual players began reaching out to Gray, asking for additional input. He approached Kiko Alonso, an early Dolphins favorite whose jersey hangs in Gray's office, differently than, say, Christian Wilkins, the defensive tackle Miami drafted 3 years later. Alonso needed technique refinement. Wilkins lost force while struggling to bend. Gray helped him incorporate more off-season technique training. In 2022, Wilkins set a single-season record, since eclipsed, for tackles by a defensive lineman, 98. Asked to describe a proper tackle, Gray, whose approach focuses on what he calls the five fights, explains, "The key is stopping ball carrier momentum. Ideally, you want to knock them back. When that's not possible, then you have to angle tackles. You have to fight to track. You want to get from A to B just before you get the ball carrier. You've got to fight to prepare. That's really important. That's within 0.00 to 2.53 meters away from the contact point. Fight to connect is literally getting a shoulder onto ball carriers. With control, with accuracy, shoulder, wrap, clamp, grip. Fight to accelerate is once you made the connection, keeping your feet running on the ground. And then finish. That's also a psychological thing. If I finish on top of you, I'm dominating you." Matt Burke, the linebackers coach for those Dolphins, and now the Texans defensive coordinator, believes Gray connected with the football players because he was both like and not like them. He can speak to all these crazy Scottish stories, all the wild stuff, but then there's real insight, Burke says. There's research behind it, things he studied from other sports. Gray tracked down Marino on that visit in Miami. He explained the jersey and Marino signed some memorabilia for him. At that moment, Gray thought, I sometimes feel like I'm here for a greater purpose. No one in Miami planned to tell anyone about Gray's influence, but that's not the NFL, where everyone gossips more than any real housewife. Adam Gase was fired as Miami's head coach on the last day of the 2018. His assistants, also let go, spread all over the league. Many took Gray's collision gospel with them. Lo and behold, Gray soon had a tree of his own, in a sport where he knew no one 2 years earlier. He began consulting with franchises all over the league. Gray's tentacles continued to spread. USA Football tasked him with writing its tackling methodology. The National Federation of High School Football adopted his program too. College teams began reaching out. Riddell, which supplies helmets to players across the NFL, partnered with GSI on a 3-year deal for exclusive manufacturing and distribution rights. So did rugby squads like RC Toulon in France. World Rugby adopted his tackling methodology standards too. The beauty in Gray's approach lay in the authenticity. He told locker rooms he didn't know the names of the star players, that he would treat them all the same. In Miami, one such player went to the office of Valance Joseph, then the defensive coordinator, and said, Coach, we love this guy, but does he seriously not know who we are? Another coach introduced Gray to Don Brown, a longtime defensive coordinator and head coach in college football known as Dr. Blitz. He wanted Gray to design something for practices to ward off cut blocks. Gray had seen teams utilize a heavy orange ball, rolling it towards defenders who were taught to block the block and shift away. But it moves in a straight line, Gray told Dr. Blitz. It's not realistic to the game at all. Gray took that starting point and fashioned an entirely new creation, a weighted foam and PVC device he called the Hammer. Coaches can throw it at players' ankles and knees or bounce it off the ground, creating unexpected angles. After Brown received the prototype, he threw it against his office wall and immediately ordered 4 more. This past June, Gray visited the Giants during OTAs. Gray believes he can make any tackler around 20% more accurate, while giving them tools to further increase accuracy when he's back across the pond. The Giants flew Gray in on a Monday. He worked with defenders from Tuesday through Thursday. Then he flew home. After impacting dozens of lives and as many livelihoods, from Brian Burns to Abdul Carter to Bobby Okereke, he's very detail-oriented. He has really broken down tackling and contact to a science, says Okereke. I'm sitting there taking notes. At this point in my career, I just love to learn. So anytime anyone's bringing me some new information that can help me level up my game, I'm all in. Okereke says Gray's lessons have left such a deep imprint that he will carry reminders onto the football field this season, almost as if hearing Gray inside his helmet. In a sport defined by margins as thin as fingernails, this matters. Gospel proliferated. 24 of 32 NFL franchises now utilize Gray's equipment and methodology. Eventually, the NFL saw what could no longer be ignored. 3/4 of its franchises found the Collision King's expertise compelling enough to reach out via Zoom or phone calls, or fly him halfway across the world for instruction. Gray says that in one 8-day stretch in August, he spoke with the Broncos, 49ers, Giants, Packers, and Raiders, 5 teams in 8 days. Gray's ambitions don't include flag football, less contact or more restrictions on defenders. He wants players he mentors to live in that millimeter before madness. Those who do, he says, are less likely to get injured, and less often. I'm going to make big changes to the game, right? Gray says, big changes. Even in his playing days, Gray understood that coaches often overtrain teams, leading to upticks in injuries sustained in practice. His ACL tear was never properly treated. Caveman tendencies mattered, but that approach baked in its limitations. His doesn't rob football of its soul. It presents a smarter, safer, more scientific approach to navigating what Gray hopes will always be a violent ethos. You can't change the essence of the game, and not just football, he says. They're there because there is a desire, and there is a need. because the human being loves to watch collision violence. We're preparing players to go into that environment and not just pay it lip service. It's going to be the right way. The point has never been to simply collide. Gray argues that technically accurate thumpers are safe thumpers, too. Gray is inventing new equipment that medical staffs can use to help players return and distributing protocols to ensure they do so safely. A major university in Scotland awarded Gray an honorary doctorate last year, making him a doctor of collisions. Gray used to say he wanted to create surgeons, not butchers. Now he says, "You're trying to create surgeons with a butcher's mentality." Johnny Gray joins her a final Zoom interview. His house in Galashiels is only half a mile from his son's. Johnny found Richie's NFL pivot interesting at first. He wasn't surprised, and yet news of the tush push, its international fame, and Richie's role in fine-tuning its effectiveness reached all the way back home, says Johnny. "I quite enjoy it." Lost in the increasingly hysteric debates over the play, Richie says he cannot find one scientific, objective study that shows the tush push is any more dangerous than a typical QB sneak. The real issue, Gray believes, is the name. There is a tush involved, but the two players behind Jalen Hurts aren't there to push him forward necessarily. They're there, Gray says, to guide him into open space. More cocoon than snowplow. In other words, a more accurate name, Gray believes, would be organized mass. A lot of the time, those two back pushers never get to Hurts, Gray says. The job's done before then. To banish the brotherly shove, Gray's preferred term, 24 owners had to vote to outlaw it. They fell too short. "I genuinely don't think the sport understands the play," Gray says. "They just see it as a big men bashing other big men. But if you actually look down on a field with a drone, there are angles and forces in play. They don't lead with their heads, and the quarterback is actually just getting a free ride. He's insulated." That's Gray's educated opinion, and the NFL seems more and more interested in what he has to say. In March 2024, officials invited Gray to their league meetings to address the hip drop tackle. He also spoke to officials from all 32 teams. Very easy, really, to show that this is not a good technique to be using in the game, he says. Soon, another round of franchises called, just as his visa ran out. Gray took calls with about 15 teams over video conference instead. When talking to league officials, Gray included his thoughts on how football, especially contact, collision, should be played. He asked what many NFL defenders want to know. Why don't they practice tackling, this central part of football, from January to July? He showed them clips of Wilkins toiling all offseason, just as Gray designed. Saints Director of Sports Science, Ted Rath, sees more buy-in of Gray and his approach at a league-wide level each offseason. Like others who know the Collision King, he wonders if one team will hire Gray and shut him off from everybody else. One NFL official has already told him that sooner or later, he will be forced to choose. Or there's a broader possibility that he will work for the league instead. A big, audacious goal, Rath calls it. But that's how this game has been invented. Richie's the guy to do it. He's going to make the tackle more productive and more efficient and keep our guys out of harm's way. The whole league should benefit from it. Were Gray ever to be made the NFL's contact collision czar, he would start by establishing a skills department for every team to make tacklers more accurate. While Gray understands why a powerful, money-printing sports league would want to keep its players safer, he also believes that the reduction in live tackling has actually made the situation worse. More than one study has found an increase in injuries each September. Gray believes that players' bodies are not fortified in the ways they could be, owing in large part to collectively bargaining restrictions on contact. But Gray sees this collusing of bodies as the less critical of the two main prongs. Accuracy matters more. Inaccuracy cannot simply be summoned in training camps. It must be built. For example, a linebacker not wearing pads will start his tackle about 3 inches farther away from the target. NFL defenders do that for 6 weeks before transitioning to pads, which presents an entirely different angle, grip, wrap, clamp, an entirely different everything. This needs to be researched, analyzed, and implemented, Gray says. Gray now accumulates airline miles the way his protégés rack up safe tackles. Before one recent flight from Newark back to Scotland, he noticed 5 middle-aged men dressed impeccably in full, colorful velour tracksuits sitting in an airport lounge. Upon boarding, Gray was seated next to them. He introduced himself. "Hey guys, you're dressed like superstars," thus hitting it off with the Sugar Hill Gang. "Have you ever heard of a song called Rapper's Delight?" one asked. Of course he had. Most anyone who meets Gray, like these 60-something rappers, will ask what he does too. "I coach contact and collision," he says. "In the U.S.? Well, yes, in fact. Have you ever heard of the Tush Push?" The next article I'll be reading is Food for Trot by Mark Bechtel. Beer, tacos, donuts, these gluttonous treats make any situation better. That's why the running community has made food races, a fun way to compete in anything from a one-miler to an ultra-marathon. Chicago couple Melanie Postel and Victor Helsinki really should have a meet-cute. She can drink 4 beers and run a mile in a little over 6 minutes. He once ate 19 samosas and ran 21 miles in a little over 6 hours. In a perfect world, they'd have crossed paths with each other jogging on a loop while stuffing their faces with deep-dish pizza or something. But no, they just met at a wedding. The fact that they are part of the city's gastronomical racing community and never met before that day shows just how expansive that universe has become. And it's not just Chicago. Raleigh has a race that combines a 5-mile run with a dozen Krispy Kremes. The Bay Area has an IPA 10K. Last year, runner and entrepreneur Simon Evers got the idea to stage a bakery half marathon in Copenhagen when his company was putting out a magazine dedicated to 10 of the city's top bakeries. When he realized the total distance between them was 13.1 miles, he took it as a sign. "It was written in the sky," he says. This September, Evers brought the idea to Brooklyn. He got 17,000 applications for 100 spots. The list goes on and on. And they all owe a debt of gratitude to France's 40-year-old Marathon du Médoc, during which runners sample wines, cheeses, and oysters. Yes, oysters. These events stand apart from, say, competitive hot dog eating, in that they replace at least some of the gluttony with something that's actually good for the body. That was what Julie Knopp was thinking when she saw Denver was hosting a 50K Taco Bell ultra marathon. She couldn't make it, so she decided to bring the idea to the Twin Cities, where she runs communications for a nonprofit. "The reason I was initially interested in distance running was primarily the training and the accountability to train, rather than the event itself," says Knopp, who ran her first marathon by herself during the pandemic. "But I think this sort of race has made the event itself something shinier, something that I look forward to. The rules are simple. Run 31.1 miles, stopping along the route at 7 Taco Bells, where you must purchase and eat a food item, including at least 1 burrito and 1 Crunchwrap." This would be an interesting place to point out that Knopp is vegan. With its ample beans and veggies, she says, Taco Bell is super customizable. You're listening to the Sports Illustrated program on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer reader, Ben. Thanks again for listening. Knopp wasn't really plugged into the Twin Cities running community, so she just posted the idea on a few Facebook groups. She got so many entries, more than 50, that she had to cap the field and cede some of the administrative work to her friend, Sarah Super, who encouraged runners on race day while dressed as a taco. Knopp mapped out the course herself, then ran it in segments, and rode it on her bike to make sure it was tenable. The response was overwhelming. A major Taco Bell franchisee reached out about partnering next year, even though Knopp didn't ask the restaurant for permission, because she was afraid they'd say no. It's the same reason she didn't apply for any permits. This whole thing was rogue, she says. A similar ethos inspired Craig Woods to start the Samosa Stumble in 2022. I came from a DIY punk rock community world, says the 43-year-old who works at Northwestern and plays in a band called The Feet. I grew up going to concerts in YMCA basements and church basements. He and a friend both live in Chicago's Little India neighborhood and became obsessed with the samosas at a restaurant called Oberio's. They're gigantic, Woods says. Not your typical tiny samosa. Woods got into ultra marathons during the pandemic and inspired by the bizarrely cruel endurance races staged by course designer Lazarus Lake, decided to come up with one of his own challenges, eat a samosa, and run 1.1-mile loop every 20 minutes until you drop out. Most of the competitors there were just north of 50 this year, come from his Rogers Park Running Club. The first couple of rounds, people are excited and happy, and it's fun, he says. People are like, this is cool, and then it gets real sick and gross after a while. I was taking that mindset of making something just fun, but super ridiculous. One four-time quitter confessed to trying to increase her appetite with pot. But it turns out marijuana is not, at least in this case, a performance-enhancing drug. The 2023 race was legendary. Hilitsky downed 19 samosas and still finished seconds. I stopped eating when I definitely reached the limit of having fun and just not finding a reasonable explanation in my mind why I'm doing this, he says. It didn't help that the Ironman vet had gone for a 50-mile bike ride that morning. Woods didn't compete in that race. He took part in the first one, stopping at 6, but now he serves as a referee, hype man, wearing a striped shirt. He taunts his runners, offering them cash to quit, and singing Boys to Men. It's so hard to say goodbye to yesterday. To each one who drops out, not very punk, Craig. He was once accused of serving spicier samosas later in the stumble, a charge he neither confirms nor denies. Knopp is gentler toward her competitors, probably because she was so moved that so many strangers, including one who came from Alaska just to take part, fulfilled her dream. I think in many ways, it's kind of a tough time to be alive for a lot of people right now, Knopp says. Many of us spend a lot of time on our phones or somewhat isolated. I think we want more joyful experiences, and there's a sense of community that you can find in these runs that is kind of scarce these days. There's an instant bond you can get when you show up to a 50K fueled by Taco Bell with 50 strangers. Training for a food race is not easy. Knopp says the key is getting used to eating while running, so she'd often heat up a frozen burrito and take it on the run with her. Past that, you're basically trying to keep the food down while maintaining your pace. On the other hand, there's the competitive beer mile. Drink a beer, run a quarter mile, and repeat 3 times. It's much more fast-paced. The men's world record is 4 minutes 27 seconds and 10 milliseconds, so the margins are tighter. That means every detail must be minded, beginning with the choice of beer. The rules specify any ABV of at least 5% in a 12-ounce bottle. That caused a problem at the 2025 Beer Mile World Classic in Portugal, Where most beers come in slightly smaller bottles, one member of the U.S. team had to check a dozen cases of beer in their luggage. "You don't want anything super flavorful, like an IPA," says the best woman's beer miler in the world, Elizabeth Lesseter. "I like Bud Light Platinum a lot, because it comes in a bottle with a twist-off cap, and that's really easy and efficient if you're just trying to drink it as quickly as possible." Lesseter got her start as a freshman at Johns Hopkins, where she ran cross-country and track. After the season, she was introduced to her first beer mile, which her teammates held at 10 p.m. on an isolated track. Beer milers can go rogue, too. "It was a needed change of pace. I had kind of a tough time with college training, just because it was pretty intense for me," she says. "So much of the time we have to be so serious, and this was an opportunity to be absolutely ridiculous and just have fun and act like total idiots." Lesseter ran 7 minutes and 37 seconds, almost beating all the men, and started thinking, "There might be a future in this." And there has been. She won 3 Beer Mile World Classics in a row, most recently with a time of 5 minutes and 56 seconds. Her three-peat came on the heels of Pozdol's 2022 title. Unlike Lesseter, Pozdol is a relatively slow runner, so she makes up her time in the chug zone, where she can put away a bottle in about 6 seconds. "She's the best chugger in the world," says Lesseter. There are a couple of reasons for this. Training regimen, for obvious reasons. Beer milers can't train with real beer. Some prefer non-alcoholic alternatives. But both Pozdol and Lesseter swear by Topo Chico Seltzer, which they say is harder to get down than a brew. "The discomfort of chugging a Topo Chico is horrible," says Pozdol. Science. Pozdol spent plenty of time filling up beer bottles with water and then pouring them into a sink at various angles to find the ideal tilt. She says it's around 45 degrees. The oboe. Yes, the oboe. Pozdol used to play it professionally. Playing the oboe requires a lot of breath control, and that breath control from the oboe very much translates to breath control in chugging, she says. A good old competitive spirit also comes in handy. Pozdol, who has also competed in a pizza mile, once entered a burger-eating competition when she lived in Montana. "I was the only female participating," she says, "and so people were like, 'She's not going to finish.' And so I was like, 'I'll show you.'" In 2019, Pozdol won a corn-eating competition outside of Chicago by putting away 5.5 ears of corn in 2 minutes. She now dreams about a competition she would almost certainly win by default. "My true goal is to do a corn-on-the-cob mile." The next article I'll be reading is, "Athletes Have Been Making Intriguing Gastronomic Choices for Years," by Mark Bechtel. Rocky Marciano, the mid-century heavyweight, ate predictable fare like lamb chops and soft-boiled eggs for breakfast. More interestingly, was his use of liquids. Rocky would rub his face with olive oil and rye whiskey twice a day to toughen it up. Next is Ed Hochuli. The NFL's most buff referee got that way with a weekly diet that had him eat sushi 3 times, chicken noodle soup 3 times, and a big salad on the other day. It wasn't all healthy, though. I have Cheetos when I'm feeling sorry for myself. Next is Martina Navratilova, an early adopter of using a nutritionalist. The tennis star followed the advice of Robert Haas, who preached low-protein, high-carb meals, pancakes for breakfast, spaghetti for dinner. He did have a cheat, a chocolate fudge cake with no chocolate. Lastly, we have Michael Phelps. The breakfast from the 23-time Olympic gold medalist 10,000-calorie diet was amazing. 3 fried egg sammies with cheese, fried onion, and mayo, 3 chocolate chip pancakes, a 5-egg omelet, and French toast. The next article I'll be reading is Recipes for Success, which goes over some notable athletes throughout the ages and their diets. The first being Wade Boggs. The Red Sox third baseman ate chicken before virtually every game in 1983 and won the batting title. He also claimed to have pounded 73 beers on one flight. This is not what nutritionalists mean when they talk about a balanced diet. Next, we have Bryson DeChambeau. After gaining 50 pounds by inhaling protein shakes and having bacon and eggs for breakfast and steak and potatoes for dinner, the long hitter began to feel weird. In 2022, he dropped 20 pounds in a month by adopting the healthier Whole 30 diet. Next, we have Fred Dreyer. The Rams lineman and soon-to-be 80s TV action star avoided meat and bread. He ate two meals a day, starting with eight raw egg yolks, applesauce, papaya juice, milk, and bran thrown into a blender, then steamed veggies at night. Lastly, we have Lou Gehrig. Two or three times a week, the Iron Horse and his mother would go fishing for eels. They once caught 86, which she would pickle and he would share with his Yankees teammates. Lou would rather eat them than caviar, she explained. The next article is a speed skating article, Ice Cold. When Brandon Kim was 8, he got hooked on short track speed skating after seeing Team USA's J.R. Kelski compete in the 2010 Vancouver Olympics. 2 years later, Kim watched Kelski become the first skater to break 40 seconds in the 500 meters. Kim never dreamed he'd reach Kelski's level, much less skate past high school. But at the U.S. Championships in September, he surpassed the three-time Olympian. Kim, now 24, broke the 500-meter national record, 39.83 seconds, during the semifinals, and won the 500-meter, 1,000-meter, and 1,500-meter events. The sweep secured Kim a spot in this fall's World Tour, which serves as the qualifier for the 2026 Winter Games, and reinforced the pre-med student's decision to take this year off from Stanford and train full-time. Before nationals, Kim hadn't raced a sub-40 500-meter. While everyone was skating 30 to 40 hours a week, I was training 5 to 7 because I had school, says the Fairfax, Virginia native. I still have a lot left in the tank. The next article I'll be reading is from ESPN.com. Bill Daly, If Olympic Ice Unsafe, NHL Players Won't Take Part, by Emily Kaplan. Colorado Springs, Colorado, NHL Deputy Commissioner Bill Daly said that if the league's players feel the quality of the ice at the Olympics in Milan is unsafe, then we're not going to play. It's as simple as that, Daly told reporters after the NHL Board of Governors meeting on Monday. Daly told league owners Monday that if he didn't believe construction issues with the Olympic ice hockey rink were insurmountable. The main hockey arena in Milan is scheduled to be finished February 2nd. The women's hockey tournament begins 3 days later, and the men's tournament, with NHL players set to participate in the Olympics for the first time in over a decade, begins February 11th, leaving very little wiggle room. The Olympic arenas will feature 3 games a day for nearly 3 weeks, which will challenge the resiliency of the ice. Daly categorized the updates the NHL and the NHLPA received last week as positive, but said the league was upping its efforts to help see through the arena. We have offered, and they're utilizing our ice experts and techniques and outside providers, Daly said. We're basically moving everybody there to try help get this done in a way that's acceptable for NHL athletes, and I'm cautiously optimistic it will be fruitful. The NHL will have ongoing access to the ice that will include being on site for a test event scheduled for the main rink from January 9th to 11th. On Monday, the IIHF acknowledged the two rinks in Milan would be about 3 feet shorter than a standard NHL rink, 196.85 feet by 85.3 feet, instead of 200 feet by 85 feet, which goes against the agreement the NHL and NHLPA signed with the IIHF in July. Daly said the league found out about the skewed dimensions last week, and he was not sure how it happened. Some federations were made aware earlier, but Daly said nobody raised the issue to him, and the league did not notice the difference in several site visits because it wasn't anything perceptible to anybody. It's not like people bring tape measures there. But the NHL and NHLPA are willing to look past that for now, though they will insist the rink for the 2030 Olympics in France is built to NHL standards. The Players Association has canvassed the players, and apparently they did not believe it to be a big issue. Health and safety issue, or a competitive issue, Daly says. The Pittsburgh Penguins and Nashville Predators played games on a similar-sized rink last month at the Global Series in Sweden. The solution was to move the line so the missing ice was accounted for in the neutral zone rather than either offensive zone. Daly said they did not receive any feedback from players after those games. Organizers have insisted there is no plan B for the Olympic hockey tournament to be held elsewhere if the rink is not ready. Daly said the NHL also does not have a contingency plan yet if it decides the ice is not suitable. I mean, it kind of is what it is, Daly said. Having said that, if you're faced with that being the reality, then you have to think about what you do next. The NHL will go dark for a 2-week period during the games. Asked if it was possible to reconfigure the schedule if necessary, Daly said he wasn't sure yet. "Well, I can't tell you exactly what we do," he said. "What I'd say is, I think in emergency-type situations like that, in the past, I think we've responded appropriately, came up with good solutions, and I have no doubt that we'll be able to come up with good solutions if we're faced with that." The next article I'll be reading is from Athlon Sports. Congratulations pour in for WNBA legend Sue Bird on Sunday. Legendary Seattle Storm guard Sue Bird received a major honor on Sunday by Iomide Abduite. Sue Bird remains one of the most decorated and influential figures in women's basketball history. A standout with the UConn Huskies from 1998 to 2002, she helped lead the Huskies to NCAA championships in 2000 and 2002, and won National Player of the Year honors in her senior season. She finished her college career with 1,378 points, 585 assists, and school record marks in three-point shooting 45.9% and free throw percentage 89.2%. Behind her leadership, UConn went on a combined 136-9 during her four seasons, establishing itself as a dominant force in the women's game. Bird was selected number one overall by the Seattle Storm in the 2002 WNBA draft and went on to build a two-decade professional career unmatched in longevity and consistency. She became the league all-time leader in assists, games played, minutes, and assists, earned 13 All-Star selections, and won four WNBA championships. On the international stage, she captured 5 Olympic gold medals and multiple FIBA World Cup titles, further cementing her status as one of the most accomplished players the sport has ever seen. On Sunday, Bird added another major milestone. UConn officially retired her number 10 jersey at GamePal Pavilion ahead of the team's game against the DePaul Blue Demons, a moment the program announced on Instagram with the message, "Number 10 is officially retired." The honor places Bird alongside Rebecca Lobo and Swin Cash as the only women's players in program history to have their numbers retired. The WNBA also acknowledged the moment, and fans flooded social media with congratulatory messages recognizing her impact on the college, professional, and international levels. "Congrats to my all-time favorite WNBA player, Sue Bird. So extremely well-deserved," one fan wrote. "Well-deserved," another fan added. "My goat," a fan posted. "Thank you, Sue. So well-deserved," another fan remarked. "Built the blueprint for so many in the next generation," said one fan. "A living legend, Sue needs more credit," another fan acknowledged. Bird's accomplishments at UConn remain some of the most iconic in women's college basketball, including her championship performances, efficiency records, and reputation as one of the greatest point guards the program has produced. Her influence has extended far beyond her playing career, and she has helped drive the league's growth. The next article I'll be reading is from Athlon Sports. Gotham FC makes first signing following NWSL championship season. Sommer has scored 6 goals in 26 international appearances for Israel. She recorded 28 goals and 24 assists in 72 games during her collegiate career at Butler. By Sean Hartnett. Fresh off lifting the 2025 NWSL championship, Gotham FC made its first acquisition of the offseason. Gotham announced the signing of Butler University and Israeli international forward Talia Sommer. Her contract will run through the 2026 season. Sommer has scored 6 goals in 26 international appearances for Israel. She recorded 28 goals and 24 assists in 72 games during her collegiate career at Butler. The 21-year-old was born in New York City. She spoke of her pride in joining Gotham FC. "Becoming a professional soccer player is an incredible milestone," Sommer said. "Joining Gotham FC makes it even more special. I'm thrilled to represent a club known for its creativity, fire, and community, and to represent my home city, New York. I can't wait to get started." Sommer is the latest addition to Amuro's attack. Gotham general manager and head of soccer operations, Yael Averbuch-West, believes that Sommer's experience playing for Israel combined with her potential mean that she'll be an exciting addition to the team. Sommer has represented Israel in UEFA Women's National League play, where she notched 2 goals and 1 assist in 4 matches. "Talia is a talented player with international experience under her belt," Averbuch-West said. "We are delighted to have her join us and look forward to seeing her development at the club." Gotham head coach Juan Carlos Amoros has excelled in developing attacking talents like Yaden Shaw and Sarah Shubutsky. Sommer's career is in good hands with Amoros and Gotham. As a teenager, Sommer played professionally in the Israeli Women's Premier League for the ASA Tel Aviv. Her efforts helped the club win an Israeli Women's Premier League championship and the National Cup. Sommer will wear the number 14 shirt. Gotham fans are looking forward to seeing her add the attacking prowess of the defending NWSL champions and CONCACAF W Champion Cup winners. The Bats will compete in the inaugural FIFA Women's Champions Cup in 2026. Gotham will face Brazilian club SC Corinthians Paulista in the semifinals in London. The final phase of the tournament will be held between January 28th and February 1st. The next article I'll be reading is from AthlonSports.com. LeBron James' decision on Lakers' future emerges during NBA season. LeBron James' stance on staying with the Lakers becomes clear. By Arnab Mondal. The Lakers have started the season as a legit contender when healthy. Luka Doncic, Austin Reeves, and DeAndre Ayton have stepped up, and the team looks more balanced than many expected. LeBron James has found in that mix. He's been distributing, sparking the offense, and still scoring when needed. He averaged 16.1 points, 4.7 rebounds, and 7.6 assists this season. That context matters because trade chatter briefly resurfaced this summer after James opted into his $52.6 million player option. Opting in kept him in LA and preserved his no-trade protections, making any deal extremely complicated. Then came the clarifying moment. Rich Paul, James' agent, joined Max Kellerman and shut down trade speculation. "No," Paul said when asked if LeBron James would be moved. "Where is he gonna go?" A short, blunt end to that rumor. "Does LeBron make the Knicks better?" "Yes, yeah, he would, of course. But 29 other teams would say the same thing," Paul said. talks about a possible move where never just rumor and noise. Teams discussed interest, but the math and logistics make a trade unlikely. He's 40, carries a massive salary, and holds a no-trade clause. Those factors limit suitors and the price teams would pay. Executives noted it would be a steep lift to construct a realistic offer. James Starr to camp was cautious after a nerve irritation. The team has been managing his workload carefully, so he's ready when it matters. Coach J.J. Redick stressed a slow ramp-up focused on long-term availability. James' past moves from Cleveland to Miami's decision to returning home, then to L.A., show he's made bold choices. But for now, the narrative is simple. He's in Los Angeles. The Lakers are built around contention, and Rich Paul just confirmed the road ahead looks set. The final article I'll be covering in today's Sports Illustrated program is on college football. David Pulak reveals Heisman Trophy winner without hesitation. This year's Heisman race features big names, historic stakes, and a clear favorite, by Jaron Spohr. The Heisman Trophy is the most prestigious individual award in college football. Awarded annually to the most outstanding player, the first trophy was presented 90 years ago. On Monday, the finalists for this year's award were announced. Indiana Hoosiers quarterback Fernando Mendoza, Vanderbilt, Commanders quarterback Diego Pavia, Notre Dame Fighting Irish running back Jeremiah Love, and Ohio State Buckeyes quarterback Julian Sain. Each of these players is having an outstanding season and could end long-standing droughts for their schools. Indiana and Vanderbilt have never had a Heisman winner, while Ohio State has not won the award since Troy Smith in 2006. Notre Dame has not had a Heisman winner since Tim Brown in 1987. On See Ball, Get Ball with David Pulak, the college football analyst stated that he believes that there is a clear favorite for the honor. "And I have the Heisman Trophy winner," Pulak said. "I'm saying he's going to win. I have no doubt saying he's going to win when you start going the geographic by geographic, because that's how this award is voted on. Like, it's important. Like, he just got all of the Big Ten. He's going to get a lot of the others now." Mendoza has had an outstanding season. He has led Indiana to a perfect 13-0 record, which marks the first time in program history that they have achieved a 13-win season. The Hoosiers also clinched their first conference championship since 1967, ending a 58-year drought. For the first time, they are ranked number one in the country. Mendoza has thrown for 2,980 yards with 33 touchdowns and 6 interceptions, while completing 71.5% of his passes. Additionally, he has rushed for 240 yards and 6 touchdowns. As the college football world waits for the Heisman announcement on Saturday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on ABC, the spotlight grows brighter on the finalists who powered his team into unprecedented territory. Whether history is made or another surprise emerges, this year's ceremony promises to add another defining chapter to the sport's most iconic individual award. We are at the conclusion of this week's Sports Illustrated program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Ben. Thank you for listening. Have a great week and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.